I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, Atlanta Drinks.
I think now is a really exciting time in Atlanta because virtually every facet of liquid culture is forging ahead. At the same time, in tandem, coffee culture, beer culture, cocktail culture, wine culture. We're one of the few cities that I know of that it's all happening at once.
It's constantly changing, and there are some fantastic coffee people in Atlanta right now, and there's some fantastic representation of where coffee is heading. A lot more craft and a lot more focus on the presentation and the service element.
One of the things that I love most about bartending is that you are creating something for someone directly in front of them. They see every step of the way. So if you don't celebrate every facet of building that cocktail, then I think as a bartender, you're actually disrespecting the tradition. It's a constant evolution of the bartending, you know, field, is that every couple of years there's a different name for what we do, but I really don't care what you call me as long as you're sitting at my bar.
At Coke, we actually call them the Coke Laboratory, exploring what they call the perfect serve. What is the perfect serving of Coca-Cola? We discovered that 36 to 37 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 degrees Celsius is the perfect temperature, but there is no other common denominator than that. Some people like it with crushed ice. Some people like it with cubed ice. Some people like it with lemons.
The first time we experimented with this, we had a customer that came in somewhere, had tried this concoction and had us make it for him. And so we started playing around with it and it tasted pretty good. And it's essentially, it's Coca-Cola with espresso. And there's some chemical reaction that happens there and it kind of foams up and it creates this kind of root beer float kind of texture. It's more of a presentation for us now where we have this tall glass bottle of Coke and we pour it in a glass, we pull the two shots of espresso and pour it on and it becomes an experience.
The cocktail drinker, or what we call them, coctillions right now, because there's this definite movement of people that are making drinks at home and they're interested in cocktail culture and they have some degree of exposure and education when it comes to cocktails. They get excited because it's like visiting, you know, a dojo. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm going to go see this dojo's kung fu style, you know? And so the coolest thing about cocktail culture, if done well, then every house has a unique style. And so it's really about the celebration of those different styles that those people will in turn take some facet of home with them in the drinks that they make for their guests and their friends and their families. So that's the idea anyway behind it.
And that's the idea we'll be exploring today. What Atlanta drinks and what drinks mean to Atlanta.
Together and share a secret laugh, and you know that goes better with Coca-Cola. Things they'll go better with Coke. Now a man and a woman with a love that's so real can even make a bag of peanuts seem like a choices meal, and you know that goes better with Coca-Cola. Yeah, things go better with Coke.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's guests are the co-founder, owner, and celebrity bartender at Holman & Finch Public House, Greg Best.
The more time I spent behind a bar, the more I realized that that was exactly where I was supposed to be. You know, I grew up doing a lot of theater and acting and stage work. And so, you know, there's not much more of a captive audience than the people sitting at your bar.
The manager of the Coca-Cola Archives Collections, Ted Ryan.
We could probably teach a history of America based on nothing but Coca-Cola advertising.
Co-founder of Octane Coffee, Tony Riffle.
You know, everybody wants a coffee shop and they want it to be a draw for the neighborhood. And there's a lot of developers and developments that the first thing they try to get is the coffee shop because they know it's going to attract other businesses and residents. It's not home, it's not the office, but it's that third place where you have a place to go.
The inventor of the Wainate Latte, Jesse Altman.
The whole company started as a cocktail. So before there was ever a Wainate Latte that was in a can, The Wainate was actually a drink on its own. It was a shot of Jägermeister dropped into a piping hot latte. And so what we basically did, and really a lot of it was inadvertent, but we had the presence of mind to realize it eventually, but we built this market for coffee as a mixer in bars.
And Angelo Fuster, a longtime regular at Manuel's Tavern, the spokesperson for three Atlanta mayors, and the founder of Exiles in Government.
We met every Tuesday. Now, that started in about 1982 or 3, and it still goes on. And it mixtures, it's people who are interested in politics, people in politics and in government, and then reporters that cover these people. You get somebody from, say, Newsweek or Time, and they will call some friend reporter here who will inevitably say, well, you need to go to Manuel's.
And our starting point today, the necessary starting point for any conversation about drinks in Atlanta, is, of course, Coca-Cola.
125 years ago on May 8th, John Pemberton brought the first Coca-Cola to Jacob's Pharmacy, which was right near Five Points now. It's always been that color, and that was actually set it apart from the ginger ales and the squashes and the lemons and all the things that would have been there at the beginning. The other thing that set it apart was its flavor. Everything else was sweet. It was sweet, sickeningly sweet. You know, sarsaparilla root beer in the early days, this would have been nauseously sweet. Coke had that bite. And then the flavor scientists, and we've had a number analyze a drink, say it's like that perfect mellow, that perfect combination of sweet, tart, all the different flavors that hits right in the middle. And that's interesting. Our own flavor scientists will say, you can't remember what a Coke tastes like. Can you think of what a Coke tastes like right now? You can probably think of what a gin and tonic tastes like.
First and foremost, it should be known that cocktails have a very similar root that Coca-Cola does. They were both kind of meant to be medicinal tonics. Coca-Cola, essentially, when it started, was very similar to like a vermouth. It was a fortified wine, basically, that was meant to stimulate and give a refreshing boost to the person who was drinking it. It wasn't until years after the recipe was purchased that it evolved into a soft drink and kind of found the way through the soda fountain and whatnot. But all of that aside, details aside, Coca-Cola is a fundamental part of this nation's drink culture, specifically this region's drink culture, of course, being the home of Coca-Cola that we're in. And if you look back through classic cocktail recipes, one of the most widely drunk and one of probably the few cocktails that never did disappear was the Cuba Libre. It's one of the oldest cocktails. It's a rum and coke with a bunch of lime, and it's fantastic. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. One of the cocktails that we created was kind of a tip of the hat in Argentina. The actual national drink of Argentina is Fernet Branca and Coca-Cola. Fernet is a very intense, herbaceous Italian digestivo or digestive liqueur. Lots of kind of herbs and spices. We loved the idea of that. We loved the idea of the Cuba Libre. So we kind of melded the two. We're using an Amaro. It's called a Southern Cola. We're using an Amaro like Fernet, but much softer. It's called Chicharo. And it's got a little bit more of kind of a candied orange peel eucalyptus profile than the intense alpine herbs that Fernet has. And then we freeze a cube of lime juice and top it with Coca-Cola. And, you know, it's this really neat, very simple at first glance. You're like, oh, it's like a rum and coke with a lime cube, you know, pretty clever. But what most people don't realize is that the entire time that the lime is melting and diffusing into the drink is constantly evolving and changing character.
We witness the same dynamic at work in the city. As its drinks evolve, so does Atlanta. And not just the taste of the city, but the actual physical landscape. In its advertisements, Coca-Cola speaks of itself not so much just as a beverage, but as a place.
Coke was where people met. The soda fountains of the 1880s would have been where you met, you know, we always say Jacob's Pharmacy, but all that Jacob's Pharmacy really was a soda fountain. People came to escape the heat, to gossip, talk about the cotton prices, and move on. You go up to the teens and the 20s. Each decade had their meeting point, and Coke was always central to that meeting point. It's interesting how it's changed over time. And one of the things that we work with at Coke is how do we get back in to being where people meet? Robert Woodruff used to say that Coke ought to be within an arm's reach of desire, and Coke ought to be where people are.
This desire to connect Coca-Cola with a place drove much of the company's marketing. And it's not marketing like we see today. These were original pieces of commissioned art, paintings. And the real meaning and substance behind these works was not just simply about enjoying Coke, but enjoying Coke
at a soda fountain, at work, at play. The purpose is to integrate Coca-Cola into situations, whether it's work, home, refreshment, sports, where it was natural. And that's where you begin to see the huge variety of the art that was produced. You have a scene of campers in Yellowstone drinking a Coke. You have Santa Claus developed in 1931. You have all the beautiful girls, but you also have the soda jerks, and you have the scenes with the couples at the baseball. All these places where Coke naturally would be were depicted with this beautiful art.
Likewise, in the case of cocktail culture, there's an interest and desire in rooting drinks to a place.
A lot of people don't know that cocktails are an American institution. We created cocktails and then did that whole, prohibition thing and negated everything that we had done. And all of our great bartenders went to, Havana or Paris and London and took root. And that's where cocktail culture continued to expand and flourish. But a lot of people think, oh, cocktails, it's a European thing, but it's not. It was inherently American. So one of the reasons that I moved into the South was to really explore this sense of the South holds on to things a little nearer and dearer to the heart. The whole idea of Holman & Finch is a celebration of our region, of the produce of our region, of the proteins of our region, local fruits, local sweeteners like sorghum syrup. In an effort to stay regional, we don't use things like balsamic vinegar in Holman & Finch. Chef Linton, what he's discovered is that you can make a balsamic out of Coca-Cola. You reduce it down with vinegar, you create this kind of gastrique, and it's fantastic. It's fantastic with food, it's fantastic in food. We actually do another cocktail called The Pause That Refreshes, where we take about a quarter ounce to a half ounce of this gastrique, pour it into a champagne flute, top it with Brut sparkling wine and a twist of lemon, a little dash of orange bitters, and it's amazing.
But the impact of drinks on our city's physical landscape is even more explicit. And one of the most conspicuous of Coca-Cola's advertising campaigns was its wall paintings.
The first ones were in Cartersville, Georgia, 1892. And it's a fascinating experience to see how it grew and how and what it became. So one guy paints drink Coca-Cola on the side of his building, delicious and refreshing, drink Coca-Cola. The four words always associate, ice cold would be six if you count it. And then by 1907, it's fully 15% of our budget, advertising budget, is painting outdoor signs. There were famous painted wall signs in Atlanta, but it was more that it was famous is that there were so many in the city. It would have covered the city the same way that billboards cover 75 South. You would have seen a painted wall sign on, if you went from one side of Peachtree to the other, you might see 20 to 30 painted wall signs. It was how they kept the brand identity and how they advertised.
One of the most innovative approaches to the relationship between drinks and the city comes in the space of coffee and in the miniaturized space of Octane's new Pocket Bar. Tony Riffle has reimagined the coffee shop, actually scaling it down to 1/10 its size so it can be inserted into some of the city's unused and uncaffeinated nooks and crannies.
We can go inside an existing building and create a space within a space. The idea just to take the full cafe concept and get it into a 500 square foot footprint. So the challenge is fitting all of the necessary stuff you don't see, like power, plumbing, grease traps, sinks, and figuring out how to make the puzzle fit. We've minimized the amount of equipment that we need and really focus on more manual methods. It's a method that anybody can do at home with a hot water kettle and a coffee grinder. So you're just physically pouring hot water through coffee grounds through a filter into a cup. And we just take that a little step further by tweaking the variables of the temperature, the weight, the size of the grind, the speed of the pour, and creating that right flavor profile. So in a sense, it's teaching customers that it's not difficult to make great coffee at home, and you don't need to spend thousands of dollars on equipment. They can smell it, it's more tangible, and it just becomes part of the overall experience.
That was Tony Riffle, co-founder of Octane Coffee. You can check out Pocket Bar's first coffee installation time at the Bank of America Plaza.
My dreamy friend, it's coffee time. Let's listen to some jazz and rhyme and have a cup of coffee. Let me show a little coffee house I know, where all the new bohemians go to have a cup of coffee.
As it happens, Atlanta's replete with coffee entrepreneurs.
My name is Jesse Altman, and I am one of the co-founders and currently the CEO of Wynate, which is a ready-to-drink, grab-and-go iced latte in a can.
Some drinks are products of fortuitous accidents, some of discoveries, still more of patient experimentation. But few drinks start first in the form of a joke.
How much would you have to get paid to drop a shot of Jaeger in that latte? So I said, Wynate.
The Wynate latte began as an idea.
That was the beginning of it.
Spread as a barroom curiosity.
And it just became this inside joke around town.
Established itself as a brand. And all that even before it got packaged as a drink.
You could go to different bars and order a Wynate. And they give you either a hot latte if they had an espresso machine. Or they give you coffee with Bailey's and kind of this pseudo latte. And they'd serve it about half full in a pint glass. Then they give you a shot of Jägermeister on the side, and you drop the shot in and you drink the whole thing. And it was really like, it was a spectacle. And whenever you'd be about to drink a Wynate, people at the bar would look at you and be like, are you really about to do that? So it got people talking, and we just decided to see if we could make it into a drink that people order by name. And before long, we actually achieved that on a very small scale. But the problem was is that bars liked the idea, and they liked the idea of the concept of coffee as a mixer. And we had a market that we created, and we just didn't have a product for it. And that was really the problem that the can solved for us, was that we had all these bars that were saying, we want to use coffee as a mixer, it's a great mixer, but it's got to be easy for us to do. Most bars are ordering the mixers, and they're all pre-made. And so we had to come up with something that would allow us to be as easy as pouring a Jack and Coke.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio, brought to you by Perkins & Will. Today's show, Atlanta Drinks. One of the most unexpected ways that drinks have shaped the city is through its politics.
How did Atlanta make it through the 60s, you know, so unscathed? Well, it was the city too busy to hate was the brand too busy to hate. That permeated Woodruff's philosophy. And that's why when King won the Nobel Peace Prize, it was Woodruff that pulled together the party, celebrated in Driving Miss Daisy. If you watch that film, the celebratory dinner for King was actually not going to happen because King was instigating a strike against the Scripto pen company, an Atlanta company. So a lot of Atlanta businesses were ticked at him. And Woodruff sent word through the leadership, no, you're going, and the party's going to be here, and I expect you all to be there. And everybody showed up. The way the company was intertwined and the way that the Atlanta business leadership was intertwined with the company, I'll illustrate it with another story. Woodruff happened to be in President Johnson's office with Carl Sanders the day that Martin Luther King was shot. And Ivan Allen was mayor, and the call went out, or they got word Martin Luther King was just shot in Memphis, Tennessee. Woodruff left the Oval Office with Johnson, went to an antechamber, picked up the phone and called Ivan Allen and said, I don't care what it costs, but make sure everything is done right. He then sent the company plane to Memphis to pick up King's body and have it brought back to Atlanta. And Coke paid for, or Woodruff, we don't know who, paid for all the added security during the funeral. And that was just the way that he operated. He wasn't going to have something bad happen in his city. He was going to make sure everything was done right.
Over the last half century, no other place embodies and imbibes the intersection of drinks and politics in Atlanta better than Manuel's Tavern.
Walter Mondale was there. Hubert Humphrey was there in 1968 when he was running for president. McGovern was there in 72. Jimmy was there. Jimmy Carter, of course.
That's Angelo Fuster. He's been the spokesperson for three Atlanta mayors and was, is, and will forever be Emanuel's regular.
I think my first visit to Emanuel's was in the early 70s when I was at Emory. You know, there were professors there who would teach classes there, even religion classes. There was a big sensation in the in the very late 60s, before my time here, in the early 70s, when one of the theology professors from Emory said about God is dead movement, and in which he was posing the theology that, you know, as God ceased to be a reality for the world. And he discussed that over there with Manuel, with Manuel himself, and brought his students there. So by the time that I got to Atlanta, Manuel was beginning to be a legend in academic circles. Manuel was not quite fully into politics yet. Then when Manuel Maluf himself became a politician, that added, you know, in addition to a neighborhood bar, it was a neighborhood bar where you could meet the head of the DeKalb County Commission, who was there tending bar. He was a barkeep. I mean, he was working. He wasn't just slumming there. And it remains a place of gathering for journalists, for reporters, for police. A lot of cops go there. And it's a place that I still think of it as home, because I'm there quite often. You know, it's one of the few places when if I don't go to Manuel, say, 3 days in a row, I get a phone call to make sure that I'm okay. So, and there are a lot of people like that. You know, it's not me. The great late writer Paul Hemphill, who died a little over a year ago, when he was being transferred to a hospice in his last days, the social worker or the caretaker who asked him, "Do you have a special place of worship that you?" And he said, "Yes, Manuel's Tavern." You know, so that it's been like that for a lot of people, and well, it is like that.
Why is it? I mean, how did it become so special? Was it Manuel? Was it the place? Was it the neighborhood? What was it?
I think the key thing though was Manuel's presence. You know, he was an old school barkeep. That's what he called himself. He tended to the place. He was there. He was an extraordinarily colorful man, blunt, irascible. Jealous of very jealous of the bar, and he was always watching. And in fact, his ashes are now over the cash register at Manuel's. You know, everybody thinks, and all the workers people who work there late at night say that they can feel him when they're counting money. You know, he watched the bar with very, very strict eyes. Well, he took the same proprietary concern about the business of the people. That's the way he would put it. So when he was chairman of the DeKalb County Commission, he was as jealous of that budget and as penny-pinching as he was at work. And that was him. That was Manuel.
Just as they say that all politics is local, the same would appear to hold true for drinks as well. For 125 years, Coca-Cola has expanded across the globe, growing to one of the largest, most respected, and most recognizable brands the world over. But even after all of that, the largest dispenser of Coke to the thirsty masses remains an Atlanta institution and one of our most recognizable landmarks.
The Varsity, it's the world's biggest single soda fountain outlet, period, the end. They run more volume at the Varsity than any other single outlet in the world. When I was growing up, the rumors were always that there was a direct pipeline from the company headquarters to the Varsity, and they didn't have to get delivery of syrup, which I don't know if it's true or not. But then in the old days with bottles, there used to be two trucks a day that would deliver the Coke to the Varsity because they did so much volume. They had their own dedicated route driver who did two deliveries a day, picking up and dropping off Coke. And so the driver would just drive the three blocks down to the Varsity, pick up all the empties and drop off all the fulls.
And with that, we've emptied the last drop from our show today. Until delivery next month, I want to thank all of my guests: Ted Ryan, Greg Best, Tony Riffle, Jesse Altman, and Angelo Fuster. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio, brought to you by Perkins & Will. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. See you next month.